From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. It will be a national day of mourning tomorrow in Sri Lanka, where at least 290 people are dead after a series of suicide bombings at churches and hotels on Easter Sunday. The Sri Lankan government has given the military sweeping wartime powers to detain suspects as authorities continue to investigate the attacks. The BBC's Azam Amin joins us now from Colombo via Skype. Azam, there was another minor explosion near a church today after authorities tried to defuse a newly discovered bomb. Are police still treating this as an ongoing situation?
Yes, police is doing a lot of such operations. They have arrested 24 suspects, so they're getting information from them and then trying to find out the other explosives, which if I left over. So they're also looking out for more suspects, so they are worried that there might be more, you know, this kind of attacks which could take place. So there have been many search operations like that. This explosion that took place was just happened a few hours ago, and where it was now police saying that it was the vehicle that the suicide bomber had come there in that vehicle and parked it and then had moved to the church yesterday. So that was the vehicle he came. So the police had found it today, and when they're trying to defuse it, the bomb has gone on, but there was no injuries because they had made sure that the public had been removed from those areas. So that is the situation. The police curfew will be imposed from 8 p.m. today as a precautionary measure till tomorrow morning. As of now, the government has announced that they're going to be bring emergency regulations tonight, which could give army more powers to act on these things.
Now, authorities are pointing the finger at a local Islamist group, little known local Islamist group. What more do we know about who was behind this attack and why they carried it out?
That information is not yet received because people are speculating a lot of things, but the motive of the attack is what a lot of people are questioning at the moment, and public is also worried why, what was the target, why, whether there was an international link for these people to do something like this, or whether this is a revenge for something else. So these are kind of speculations are there, but there has been no firm detail from either from the government or the security forces about the motive for these attackers. So there have been some reports of prior intelligence had been received about this attack, which the prime minister and the cabinet had blamed on police, saying that police didn't act on it and even not informed the government about it. So that is what's the situation. So investigations are underway. You know, police is saying that they are expecting to arrest more people who are behind these attacks.
Now, we know that nearly 300 people died in these attacks so far. There are 500 or so injured, about 35 at least foreigners among the dead, including Americans. What more do we know about the victims?
I mean, most of the victims are from Catholic churches, so they were there for prayers. So there was a lot of children also in some of the churches. So, and even when it comes to foreigners, they were in the Colombo main five-star hotels. They were having Easter breakfast, so that is where they had been targeted.
Now, for people that don't know much about Sri Lanka, it's a country of a little more than 20 million people. It is mostly Buddhist. There is also a big Hindu population. There is a Islamic population as well, and even a pretty large Christian population there. How are people feeling today after this? It's been 10 years now since the civil war there ended, but this is a very violent moment in Sri Lankan history.
Exactly. People are very much shocked. First, I mean, no one was expecting this kind of, you know, massacre. You know, they're well-coordinated, well-planned. So everybody's the main question, why Sri Lanka? Why this is happening in our country? So that is the main feeling of a lot of people. So there have been some racial tensions as well with the suspects who have arrested being armed from the local Muslim community. So the government, you know, that we, as a precautionary measure, also took down social media, especially Facebook, you know, to control disinformation and misinformation. There's a lot of panic. There's a lot of fear because there have been several explosives found in various places. One was in a bus stand where the 87 detonators were found. So people are in kind of panic, you know, to do their normal day-to-day activities and because of fear of more attacks or fear of more explosives that have been hidden.
That's the BBC's Azam Amin joining us from Colombo.
Well, this morning, President Trump was asked by reporters if he was worried about impeachment after the Mueller report, which detailed members of his campaign interacting with Russians, and also said if investigators could have cleared Trump of obstruction, they would have. They didn't charge him either. The president said he was not even a little bit worried about impeachment. His lawyer made the Sunday morning show rounds. And today, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi will conduct a conference call with her caucus to talk about whether impeachment is on the table. Presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren is calling for it, saying it's a constitutional responsibility. NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith is here for our Monday morning roundup. Hi, Tam.
Hi.
And remind us first, on what basis are those calling for impeachment doing so?
It's on a number of matters, but primarily obstruction of justice. The idea that the Mueller report outlined numerous examples of President Trump trying to impede the investigation, ordering or otherwise directing his aides to make it go away or get rid of Mueller. Though, interestingly, today, President Trump was they just didn't do it. Like the Mueller report found that on a number of occasions, President Trump directed his subordinates to take an action and they simply didn't take that action. Earlier today, the president was asked about this. The question from the reporter was, are you worried that some staff disobeyed your orders? And the president said, nobody disobeys my orders, though there are a number of people who, at risk of perjury, said that they absolutely disobeyed his orders.
Okay. And there were things like deleted emails in the investigation. Here's House Judiciary Committee Chair Gerald Nadler on NBC's Meet the Press with Chuck Todd.
If proven, some of this would be impeachable. Yes.
All right.
Obstruction of justice, if proven, would be impeachable.
And you're going to go about to see if you can prove it?
Well, we're going to see where the facts lead us.
And as we said, Elizabeth Warren agrees. But what is the other conversation among Democrats about whether or not to take that route?
So the challenge that they are facing is a political one. And of course, impeachment is a political process. But what they're looking at is the House of Representatives could vote today to impeach President Trump, but they wouldn't be able in the Senate. They wouldn't convict because the Mueller report came out. And aside from Mitt Romney expressing deep concern about some of the things that he saw in the report, Republicans fell in line with the president. And so Democrats were out on the Sunday shows talking about how essentially at this time there really isn't a path. But part of the conversation that's going to be happening in this conference call with Democrats that Nancy Pelosi is having on the House side today and ongoing conversations with the committees that are investigating the president is maybe they don't talk about impeachment now, but could that be the final conclusion of a lengthy process? Maybe, maybe not. But a lot of these Democrats were out there saying, hey, we don't want to set a bad precedent. We don't want to make it so that the president is above the law. And so they do feel some obligation to at least move forward, certainly call Robert Mueller to testify and take it step by step. That's sort of what you were hearing in that clip from Gerald Nadler of the Judiciary Committee.
Well, what to make of the president's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, who was on the talk shows yesterday, insisting not just that there was no collusion. The report, of course, said collusion isn't a thing and detailed interactions with the Russians, but didn't conclude conspiracy. But Giuliani went further. Here he is speaking to CNN's Jake Tapper.
There's nothing wrong with taking information from Russians.
There's nothing wrong with taking
information. It depends on where it came from. You're assuming that the giving of information is a campaign contribution. You read the report carefully. Mm-hmm. The report says we can't conclude that because the law is pretty much against that.
Now, the law says you can't take donations or anything of value, meaning information from a foreign entity. What's Giuliani doing there?
Giuliani is on a number of matters, very closely focused on, well, the president wasn't charged. And at another point, he was talking again about this, receiving information by way of Russia, by way of WikiLeaks. And he says, you know, that isn't what prosecutors look at, morality, he says. So he is putting a real focus on you know, what is prosecutable? The president wasn't prosecuted, isn't being prosecuted for obstruction of justice. So case closed, move on.
Okay. Well, we are moving into a week in which we are getting more presidential candidates. Massachusetts Democrat Seth Moulton announced his candidacy this morning. Biden is expected later this week. That'll round it off at 20, I believe. Just quickly on Moulton, in the 30 seconds we have, what is he saying he can add?
Well, he was elected to Congress in 2014. He served four tours of duty in Iraq as a Marine. And he is talking about being a new generation of leader. But in terms of the issues he's talking about, he is very much a sort of standard down-the-middle Democratic candidate. He fits that mold.
NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Tamara, thank you.
You're welcome.
In Canada, the province of Quebec is considering a bill that would ban public workers in positions of authority, including police officers, teachers, bus drivers, and more, from wearing religious symbols while on the job. Symbols such as Muslim hijabs, Jewish kippahs, and Sikh turbans. The bill was introduced last month, but has been tabled for now after getting a mixed reception from the public. Let's hear first from a supporter of this bill, Bill 21. Joining us now is David Rand, spokesperson for the Alliance for Secularism and president of an organization called Atheist Freethinkers. David, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, why do you support a ban on civil servants wearing religious clothing while at work?
Well, because I support secularism, which means separating religions from the state, civil servants should present a neutral image to users of public services. It's not enough that they be neutral. They also have to have an appearance of being neutral. And there's already a law in Quebec which forbids state employees from wearing partisan political symbols while they're on the job. And this just extends it to religious symbols, which it should do. Unfortunately, it doesn't extend it to all public servants, but at least it extends it to some, those in positions of authority.
But why would somebody wearing a turban or a kippah or a headscarf be seen as not neutral to you?
Well, it's obvious they're not neutral because they're advertising their religion while they're working in a position where they should be neutral. And even if their actions are neutral, their appearance certainly is not. And it's a form of passive proselytizing, not necessarily for their religion, but they're proselytizing for their community. And they're saying that their identity as a member of a certain religion is more important than their identity as a worker of the government or a teacher in the public school. And this is not acceptable.
What do you say to those, though, including Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who say this bill is legitimizing discrimination against people based on their religion?
Well, that's wrong, and that's really dishonest to say that. It discriminates against no religion. It applies to all religions, and it's not about people. It's about behavior. It's a small and reasonable restriction on behavior for some people in the public service while they're on the job. It says they have to take off their religious symbols, which they can do.
Do you think that this bill will be successful? This is the fourth legislative attempt in the past 8 years in Quebec to regulate the wearing of religious symbols by public workers, and other attempts have been unsuccessful.
I think it will be successful. Actually, I think it's only the second. You may be counting attempts, which I might not count for various reasons. But forgetting the history for the moment, it will be successful this time in all probability because the government is a majority government. It has the population behind it. The majority of Quebecers strongly support this kind of legislation. And it's already indicated its intention to use a so-called notwithstanding clause if the legislation is challenged in the courts. And that's a very good thing because we know from history that the enemies of secularism are extremely virulent and they will do anything, including spreading misinformation, as Justin Trudeau is doing, to oppose it. And so the government has declared, we will take all necessary measures to make sure this law passes. They have the support of the people, and it's the right thing to do.
You think that Justin Trudeau is an enemy of secularism?
In his behavior, certainly, yes. He is very sympathetic to religious communities. He practices clientelism. That is, he tries to get votes by, you know, embracing various religious communities, usually Muslims and Sikhs. But it's not just all Muslims and all Sikhs. He tends to go for the ones who are the most obvious, the most fundamentalist, the most pious, and which do not necessarily represent their community the best. There are many Muslims here in Quebec who support this legislation.
David, there's a clause in this legislation that would grandfather in people who are already working for the government, and they would be allowed to continue to wear whatever they wear for their religion. Do you think that that makes sense, that you would have possibly two co-workers sitting next to each other? One can wear a hijab, one can't?
No, I don't like the grandfather clause. I think it should not be there. However, this legislation is a compromise. It's certainly not perfect, but it's nevertheless a major step forward for secularism in Quebec. Probably the best thing about this law is that it inscribes the principle of secularism in the Quebec Charter of Rights and Freedoms and says the Quebec state is secular. And what that means is that in future, it will help to set the direction for further secularization. It may help to get rid of the grandfather clause. It may help to extend the ban on religious symbols to other workers that aren't covered by the current legislation. It may help to end fiscal privileges for religions, which is a major question which is not dealt with by this law. The law is incomplete. It's certainly not perfect, but it's a very good step in the right direction.
That is David Rand, spokesperson for the Alliance for Secularism and president of an organization called Atheist Freethinkers. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, for another view, we are joined by City Councilor Lionel Perez, who's the leader of the opposition in the city of Montreal. Last Monday, the City Council voted unanimously to adopt a declaration opposing Bill 21. Lionel Perez, welcome to you.
Thank you for inviting me.
And first of all, what did it mean to you that the City Council came together to oppose Bill 21? You wear a kippah.
That's right. Well, I think it was it sent a really strong message to the Quebec government. The Quebec government has tried to suggest that there's strong consensus throughout Quebec about this law. And what we were able to show was that there is no such consensus, at least not in Montreal. And I believe that's sent a strong message.
Well, what's the main argument that you're making against this bill?
Well, I think everybody is in agreement of the concept and the principle of separation of church and state. What we feel is that they're going too far. When they start restricting certain positions to work for the state, then we believe that's a violation of fundamental rights and freedoms, and that that should only be done in the most exceptional cases when there's an actual correlation between what you're wearing, for example, and the actual task of the job. That hasn't been demonstrated.
Well, David Rand, who is in favor of this ban, told us that he thinks it's necessary to create an appearance of being neutral on the job. What do you say to that?
What I say is, what is the job?
Well, a police officer, a teacher, or something like that.
Okay, so let's say you're a police officer. Does the fact that someone wears a turban or hijab makes them less partial? That's the main argument. And what we're saying is, that's a question of a stereotype, that you think that because someone is religious, they can't follow rules, they can't follow directives or policies. Well, that's just erroneous. That's reducing to the lowest common denominator what they think of, you know, human nature. I reject that out of hand. People are to be judged on their abilities, on their qualifications, and what they do, how they act. If ever there's any kind of complaint against them, guess what? We have all the mechanisms and the checks and balances in place.
Well, some supporters of Bill 21 say that if Muslim women choose to wear a hijab, for instance, that the garment is rooted in the idea of women being inferior, and so getting rid of it would reinforce gender equality. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that we live in a society where individuals, men and women and others, are able to make their own minds. We shouldn't presume that because perhaps in certain countries there's some kind of religious or cultural imposition, that is automatically taken here in Quebec and in Canada. So I'd rather err on personal choice rather than me telling somebody why they're doing what they're doing. And the whole point of church and state, one of the important principles behind it, is the state should not tell people how to practice their religion. And that's what exactly what the government is doing. They're actually violating the very principle they're saying they want to protect.
So what do you make of the fact that a recent poll found 67% of people who live in Quebec agree that police officers, judges, and prison guards should not be allowed to wear religious symbols at work? Do you think you're going to be facing an uphill battle here with Bill 21?
Well, I think there's a couple points. First of all, that poll that came out was commissioned by the actual political party of the government. It was not a government poll that was done. We don't have all the information. They just gave us bits and pieces and the data that they wanted to share. There was others that actually questioned the methodology and the way the questions were very leading into a certain direction. Number two is they never give the specific data for the island of Montreal, for the city of Montreal, where there's the strongest opposition. And that's because there is a divide between the urban center of Montreal, the largest city in Quebec, and the more rural areas where the government was elected. Other cities on the island from smaller municipalities have also questioned it. School commissions have questioned it. So I think that there is a strong opposition. I also think that there's a little bit of fatigue in the population. The government has branded this as saying, let's just pass this law and let's move on. Let's put it behind us. Because we've been talking about this for over a decade, there's been a couple of different laws that have been tried to been passed unsuccessfully that people say, you know what, if this is going to solve the matter, then fine, let's just be done with it. The problem is it really doesn't. It's not going to solve because integration, welcoming immigrants, which we're welcoming more and more every year, and of which Montreal receives 75% of all immigrants in Quebec, shows that there's always going to be these challenges. The question is, how do you deal with these challenges?
That's Lionel Perez, who is a city councillor in Montreal. He is opposing Bill 21, and we'll link you to more about it at hereandnow.org. Lionel, thank you.
My pleasure. Anytime.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, EmberWave. EmberWave, the revolutionary personal thermostat that is designed to help you feel cooler or warmer at the press of a button. EmberWave can put you in control in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, restaurants, trains, cafes, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018, learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Ember Wave. Control your comfort.
'69-year-old Larry Mitchell Hopkins appeared in court today in New Mexico on firearm charges. Additional charges of impersonating law enforcement and kidnapping may soon come. After videos surfaced showing Hopkins and members of the militia group, the United Constitutional Patriots, claiming to be border agents and holding hundreds of asylum seekers and migrant families at gunpoint. In one of them, a man can be heard alluding to another tactic he wishes the militia could use.
The only problem is if we shoot on the hill, it'll be an international crisis. We're too close to the border. Would save some time, though, wouldn't it?
Angela Cocherga is a border reporter for the Albuquerque Journal. Angela, you've had past in-depth interviews with both Larry Mitchell Hopkins and the group spokesperson. We'll post them. They say migrants are free to go. They're not kidnapping. What else do they say?
So they dispute the term militia, which originally is what they were calling themselves. They say they're volunteer patriots, and they are there to help Border Patrol protect the border. They're in Sunland Park, New Mexico, which is a small border town right near across the state line from El Paso, Texas. They admit stopping groups of migrants, mostly parents and children seeking asylum, and they say holding them for Border Patrol, and there's some dispute over whether the migrants, in their view, they say are free to go. The migrants clearly are confused and think they are under arrest.
Well, and many don't speak English, and so someone is pointing a gun at them with badges and things, and so they probably don't think that they can move. What does the Border Patrol say?
Well, the Border Patrol is not commenting on this specific instance, but I've talked to Border Patrol in the past, and they say this group and others, private citizens, are, you know, can come to the border and watch. And of course, New Mexico is an open carry law, so they can be armed. But citizens are encouraged to report illegal activity, not to take the law into their own hands. So that's a concern. This group has been camped out for several weeks now. prompted by news of the influx of migrant families. And before that, along another stretch of New Mexico border, when last fall, when President Trump was talking about caravans of invaders coming up to cross over.
Hopkins was arrested on these firearm charges because he is a felon. He has been arrested for impersonating a border agent before and for having firearms to do that. And Hopkins is on a YouTube video claiming to have had interaction with the president. Do we know if he has?
We don't know. When I interviewed Hopkins last month, he said, you know, they had lots of members of this group out there protecting the border. I was out there a few days ago and observed six people, half a dozen people, including one woman. Again, the concern is that are the people there, they say they are stopping people, and they will even chase after people. They say not to arrest them or take them into custody, but to see where they're going. But clearly the migrants, are many from Central America, see people in camouflage, heavily armed, and they're going to pay attention.
It'll be interesting to see how far this goes, and if we will hear an argument for the right to bear arms to protect the country, which is, again, what they say they're doing, as opposed to performing the role of law enforcement, which is illegal. We note that PayPal and GoFundMe have banned them. Who's funding them?
They have support online with some of these viral videos. The spokesperson, you hear his voice on there, Jim Benvey, describing what they see on the border. So they might be getting some funding that way from individuals. But it's really unclear who's funding this.
Angela Kucherga, border reporter for the Albuquerque Journal there in New Mexico. Angela, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
The Danish band Town Portal may not be on your radar, but over the last 10 years, the trio has attracted a devoted fan base with extensive European tours, rave reviews on music sites like Stereo Gum and Invisible Oranges. Town Portal's new album, Of Violence, just came out, and it features the band's mix of metal and melody. Think of it as a soundtrack for discordant times. When Here Now's Alex Ashlock visited Denmark recently, he also visited the band.
I took the ferry across the Copenhagen Canal to a part of town called Refshaleon. That's where I met the members of Town Portal.
Morten Austrup Nielsen, I play bass.
Christian Henrik Ankerstjerne, I play guitar.
Malik Brewer Bistrup, I'm the drummer.
Town Portal recorded the new album at Black Tornado Studios.
The building we're in now is actually an old school.
That's Christian, the guitar player.
So this area was known for having like a giant shipyard and building giant ships. And this was the school where all the kids of the workers would go. So it's like there's just a lot of cool history baked into the walls here. And not that many people from Copenhagen know this area well until the last couple of years, because I mean, we had a reason to come out here because this is where there's like space to be noisy and practice spaces and workshops and that kind of thing. And I think it's the gem of the city, but it's changing a lot.
The change includes a bit of gentrification. There's a world-famous restaurant called Noma and an artificial ski slope that's on top of a building that houses a trash incinerator. The industrial backdrop was the perfect setting for the first Town Portal record in 4 years. The trio recruited California's Scott Evans from the band Kowloon Walled City to come to Copenhagen to produce the new album. Morten, the bass player, says Evans spent some long, sweaty days with the band recording the record last May.
It was so sunny here, and I think Copenhagen was just like prettier than ever. And he was like, I'm gonna move here. And we said, like, don't. Because this is like 1% of the time, but that's what he got.
In the past, Town Portal has basically self-recorded its albums. But Christian says having Evans in the control room this time freed the band to do what it does best.
I don't think, maybe Malik is a pretty exceptional player, but I think otherwise we're not doing like, you know, super quick solos or something. That's not really what we're good at. I think like hearing it from other people made me realize that what we're good at is actually playing together and like that kind of like invisible communication you have when you've played together for a long time and our sounds meld together into one big sound. And like, if that's what you're good at, it seems obvious you should record it together in a room live. So that's what we did.
Reviewers use a variety of words to describe Town Portal's music. It's heavy, dark, foreboding, but also playful and reflective. Where does that sound come from? Christian says his father listened to a lot of Steely Dan, but he grew up reading music blogs leading him to bands he doubts anyone has ever heard of. So I turned to Morton.
I don't know if I should start from like the cool part or the honest part, but the honest part is definitely Michael Jackson.
Malik, the drummer, says his musical taste leaned more toward the heavy metal American band Tool.
There's a big gap between Tool and Michael Jackson.
Yeah, I guess I did get into metal at 11 or 12 with Tool. Let's call that metal for a while. And soon listening to stuff like, yeah, well, Meshuggah was another big thing that came in when I was like maybe 14, 15. Really cool drums and insane grooves and a lot of records already that I could just discover.
This is a song, Better Angels. Christian says it's a reference to the Steven Pinker book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, which argues that despite popular perception, the world has become less violent, not more violent, over recent human history.
But it's not like as such meant to be a political record. It's more like perspectives on things going on. And I think violence is kind of a key word that you can explode into a lot of different angles that, I don't know, it somehow seemed fitting for capturing a lot of the thoughts we'd had, yeah.
One of those thoughts is that violence today takes on different shapes. Morton says the song Archright was sparked by concerns about the rise of populist nationalism across the globe.
It was a way of trying to get at this notion of someone having like a birth-given right that others don't have. And this, like, adding this prefix, this arch, made it feel ridiculous in some way, because I think, like I think Christian coined this one, and like he said, it's pretty much an empty prefix. Like, what is an arch anything? Like, what does it make, the noun that comes after it? With Arch Right, it just felt like poking at this idea, this notion, to expose how it would fall apart.
You may have noticed by now that there are no lyrics in any of Town Portal's songs, and that's one thing Malik says is most appealing about being a member of this band.
Yeah, big difference. It was actually one of the big things with me for metal. And one of the reasons I don't listen to a lot of metal anymore is that the singer always just bothered me. I thought, you know, something that is also metal, but also a lot of other things, with no vocals. Yeah, I thought that was going to be fun for 10 years, which it's been.
Christian says being an instrumental band gives each member of Town Portal freedom to experiment and shape songs that don't rely on words.
I think it feels boring sometimes to repeat the exact same part. So we started like doing these. We would like call it spin-off parts where we'd be like, we like this part, but can we take the chords, different rhythm, or take the rhythm, different chords, or all these different ways of swapping stuff around and making all these iterations. And in the end, you can't really recognize where it came from. So it ends up feeling like a song that just has like 10 parts. But I think we also really like that, like the narrative, like the storytelling and these weird points of no return where the mood changes and that kind of thing. Yeah, I think.
The cover of Town Portal's new album, Of Violence, features an erupting volcano. It seems appropriate for the way this music sometimes sounds, but it stands in contrast to the band's name, which reflects a concept that Malik says gamers will understand.
It's from a series of computer games. I thought it was a beautiful concept of casting an easy spell and walking through it, and then you're where you want to be. You're back to safety. You're home.
Town Portal is touring Europe right now. The band plays a festival in Luxembourg this weekend. The trio hopes to come to the U.S. next year. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
A group of European scientists will head to Antarctica later this year to study some of the world's oldest ice, around 1.5 million years old, to be exact. The scientists believe that the ice can tell us something about climate change. Joining us now is Professor Olaf Eisen, a glaciologist and geophysicist at the Alfred Wegener Institute in Germany. He's also the coordinator of the Beyond Epica Oldest Ice Mission. Professor, welcome. And what are you going to be looking for specifically in this ice in Antarctica?
We are looking for especially the gas content of the ice, because ice cores are the only archive which allow us to directly investigate the composition of the past atmosphere. And what we're mostly interested in is the composition of the atmosphere in terms of carbon dioxide and methane in the time period between 800,000 years and 1.5 million years ago.
How do you make sure that when you're looking at the gas that is in this ice, that it doesn't get mixed with today's air?
Oh, it's a very, very sophisticated process, and it's really an extraction of the air in a very clean environment. You also make sure you don't take the air samples, like the bubbles, from the outside, but you really cut an inner part of the ice core and extract the air only from that part.
And the ice that you're looking at in Antarctica, some of it is, what, 1.5 million years old?
That's what we aim for. We want to have an ice core which goes back from today until 1.5 million years ago.
Wow. And you know, the interesting thing is, for those of us who don't live in Antarctica, ice, you know, comes in and is gone by the next spring at the very latest. So it's interesting that the ice has been able to last that long there.
Yeah, Antarctica has been a glaciated continent for about 34 million years already. But because the climate has been changing over that time, we probably don't have ice which is several tens of million years old. But we are sure that there's ice which is at least 2 million years old.
How do you drill down into the ice there?
You have a ring with three cutters usually, and the cutters cut away a ring in the ice. And in the inner part of the drill, there's an empty barrel, and you just move downwards, and then the ice comes up in the barrel, and at a certain length, around 3 meters, 10 feet, you turn the drill in another direction, and then there are another pair of cutters which rip off the inner part, and then you can lift up the whole drill with the ice core inside.
So what questions do you think you're going to be able to answer when you look at this ice?
The most important question we have is, what made a change in the periodicity of cold and warm times, glacials and interglacials, which have been changing on a 40,000-year time scale until maybe 1.2 million years ago, and have been changing with a 100,000-year time scale, 100,000-yearism, since about 900,000 years ago? What made this change? We know from marine sediments drilled from the seafloor that this change occurred, but those marine sediments don't tell us anything about the composition of the atmosphere. So this is really about also in understanding the long-term influence of a higher than average carbon dioxide content or methane content in the atmosphere. What we have today is the highest carbon dioxide content in the atmosphere than we know of over the last about 3 million years. And the humankind as a species doesn't have any experience with an environment with that a high carbon dioxide content in the atmosphere. So we really want to see if there are other elements in the climate system we do not know about and which might be some sort of tipping points in the future which we should be aware of.
I've talked to scientists before about climate change, and one of the things that I've heard is that if you want direct evidence of climate change, the best place to go is to the ice in Antarctica, because it's like chopping down a tree and you look at the tree rings and you can see exactly what's happened in the past.
Exactly. And that's what has been done over the last 20, 30 years, not only in Antarctica, but also in Greenland. Greenland is younger, just 150,000 years old, but we got several ice cores there. And every time we learn something new about our climate system. And the comparison with the tree ring is really what we have. We just go down in the ice, and the deeper we go, the older the ice is, because the ice is usually very nicely layered.
Now, the project is expected to take 5 years. Are you and the other researchers going to be living in Antarctica that whole time?
I hope not. Dome Concordia, Dome C at the Concordia station, it's one of the coldest places on the continent. Temperatures go down to minus 70, minus 80 degrees Celsius, which is, I think, minus 100, 60.
Really
Fahrenheit,
cold, anyway,
Fahrenheit.
Whatever it is.
Yeah, whatever. It's very cold. It's way below minus 40. We will only be there from the time between November and January. At that time, you can live in a field camp with heated containers. But outside of that period, it's just way too cold. So we will have teams of people going down there every year for 5 years. Sometimes the same people 2 years in a row, but often also changing, because going down there every year is quite a burden on your person, on the body also.
That is Professor Olaf Eisen, who's a glaciologist and geophysicist at the Alfred Wegener Institute in Germany. He's going to be headed to Antarctica to look into the world's oldest ice. Professor, thank you for joining us and good luck.
Thank you very much. Nice to talk to you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.